am Nancy Wilson.
Mike Campbell.
Mark Mother's Bathroom Devo.
Hey, it's Adam from Counting Crows, and I am here giving you the story behind the song.
The story behind the song is back for season four. I'm Peter Chidi of Deep Cuts Media, and this season we're diving even deeper into some of music history's most iconic tracks with the legends who made them.
What's so beautiful about it is a lot of people connect with, you gotta live your life and don't let the big man push you down. Don't have to live like a refugee, can't keep fighting for what you believe. And that was Tom.
From the spark of inspiration to untold tales from the studio, we unlock the true stories that shape the music you love.
At the time on the radio, there was a really cool riff by Nazareth covering a Joni Mitchell song, This Flight Tonight. It had the same groove, but I think Barracuda kind of blew it out of the water.
Join us as we all sit down with music icons like Devo, Heart, Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Sublime, Counting Crows, and so many more. New episodes are out now from the Consequence Podcast Network, so tune in wherever you get your podcast and join me for the story behind the song.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Am I framed okay? I can't see anything.
Consequence Podcast Network.
And welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks for making your way here. For checking out the series, if you're not already, I hope you hit that subscribe button. You'll get new interviews just like this one sent to you every single week, multiple times a week. Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions. Anywhere you get your podcast from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With, and I hope you leave a rating and a review wherever you're listening from as well. We've had some great guests lately. Shirley Manson of Garbage was here. Mark Hamill, Mr. Luke Skywalker, he's starring in The Life of Chuck, the new Mike Flanagan, Stephen King collaboration. Finn Wolfhard of Stranger Things was here, just released the first album under his own name after some years in bands. We talked with Imperial Teen and Rainer Maria. Auli'i Carvalho, the voice of Moana. Lenny Waronker was here. John Densmore of The Doors. Hannah John Common from Thunderbolts. Gene Simmons from Kiss. Kevin Bacon. Jennifer Nettles from The Righteous Gemstones. Adam Duritz of Counting Crows. Just an example of what you get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. That's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, my guest, Seth MacFarlane. Before creating The Family Guy, he was a classically trained singer, a Rhode Island School of Design grad, and the kind of guy who pitched a show by doing every character voice himself. He's since turned that one show into an empire: American Dad, The Cleveland Show, The Orville, a music career, a few billion TED jokes later. He is everywhere and somehow underrated at the exact same time. He is back with his ninth album. It's called Lush Life, The Lost Sinatra Arrangements. And it's definitely what you would call a passion project, built from unreleased Frank Sinatra charts gifted to him by Sinatra's family. Seth digs into what drew him to orchestral jazz, recording at Abbey Road, why classic arrangers like Nelson Riddle and John Williams still reign supreme. He's also going to unpack why today's post-heavy music creation loses the magic of the moments. He's going to share his admiration for vocal harmony groups like the High Lows, reveal how he co-wrote unfinished Sinatra material without losing the spirit of the originals. And of course, beyond the music, we're going to talk about him producing the new Naked Gun movie with Liam Neeson, rebooting The Burbs for a new generation, and why Ted is still giving comedy fans exactly what they need. Oh, and he's doing Sinatra in Vegas. All that's and a whole lot more. One of my favorite conversations. We're talking Lush Life, The Lost Sinatra Arrangements. It's Kyle Meredith with Seth MacFarlane.
How's it going?
I'm well. It's such a pleasure to have you on here. I've been such a follower, of course, of all the different parts of your career for such a long time. And to finally get to talk to you seriously about Sinatra, I feel like this is the moment. This is the moment.
So. This is everything's been leading up to this.
It has been leading up to it. You've been, I mean, yes, you know, you've had this amazing career with the Family Guy, with Ted, and with everything on that part. But you've been a musician your whole life. This is, I believe, your 9th album now. Is that right?
Yeah.
For you as a musician, this stretches all the way back.
Yeah, I mean, I was doing it in one form or another. Well, I mean, look, there was a lot of music in my house as a kid. My parents put me in a church choir, if you can believe that. You know, our local town productions of you know, various shows and such included a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan. So I was doing that from the age of 9 or 10, and then just kind of stuck with it. And when I came out to LA to do Family Guy, I think it was about 2009 or so, Alex Borstein and I did a live show for Fox. It was like a one-off special that was comedy, that was music, and we had an orchestra there. And Universal Republic Records said, hey, do you want to do a record of some kind? I said, sure. And they said, what do you want to do? And having left it up to me, I was like, my God, last thing I want to do is more shit jokes. So I said, I'd love to do like an actual serious fucking orchestral recording album of great songs. And so astonishingly, they said yes. And that was 2010 that we did our first album, Music is Better Than Words, with Joel McNeely. And since then, we've just kept going. You know, we've recorded a number of these at Abbey Road, always with a world-class orchestra of about, you know, maybe 50 or 55 players.
Mind-blowing, that right there. Like, you got to a point in your life where you can record in Abbey Road multiple times with a full orchestra, you know? Like, even when you were in the choir, was this the type of music that you were into? Did you get into it later on? I mean, when did that happen?
In some ways, I had a very eclectic musical taste when I was a kid. I did listen to a lot of the stuff that was being, you know, shoveled at us at the time. But I also was a big fan of film scores. My love for John Williams blossomed when it was in the 80s, when that, you know, his, all this one right after another, all these great scores came out. And I kind of found my way into this kind of music through that. When I heard Sinatra and really listened to him for the first time in college and started exploring the music of his contemporaries, what I found was not just a collection of great vocalists, but also orchestrations that were so far superior to anything I was hearing at the time from the music industry. I mean, these guys were using, they were recording pop songs like what we're hearing now, except they were using 55-piece orchestras with some of the greatest arrangers who ever lived. And it was like, God, this is like classical level musicality, but it's accessible pop music. And it was really the only time in history that that ever happened with such frequency, and that it was so mainstream. So I found my way into that stuff through the back door, through the orchestras. I was listening to what was going on behind Sinatra, and even with his, you know, unmatched vocals removed from the track, it was, what you were hearing from the orchestra was so special and so sophisticated and asked a lot of the listener in a good way.
That's interesting, because you're just a few years ahead of me, but so much of, like, even growing up, I mean, it's been told a million times, like, if you grew up watching things like Looney Tunes, like that classical music was just ingrained into you and you didn't even know it, you know, and you
didn't even know it. And what we all kind of take for granted is that was Carl Stalling who wrote all that music for Looney Tunes. And what you kind of take for granted is how much more difficult it is to do something like that and to do it well than it is, you know, to get in and record a contemporary pop song. It's like he had to, you know, those little streamers that go by on the screen, because there's so much action, the tempo changes every few seconds, and it's a full orchestra that have to keep up with each person has to keep up with the person next to him and with everyone else in the ensemble. And you got to keep up with the conductor, and everything changes on a dime every few seconds. There was a while ago, they released recordings of all of those Carl Stalling charts. And I remember listening to them anew and just having my mind blown as far as how the hell do these guys do this? Like, it's just the level of talent and the level of sophistication. I mean, every single musician had to be, Oscar Peterson. I mean, they all had to be the best of the best of the best in order for this to even kind of work.
Especially when you look back then, like I hear that in different parts, when you hear about the Wrecking Crew, that the fact that the Wrecking Crew existed all at the same time and they did, like everybody was such, if you made it to that level, there was a reason. I think it was a Tom Petty quote that I like about him saying, like, everybody had a band back in the 60s and 70s, but to get to a recording studio, like you already had to be worth it. It's like to have that level of musicianship performing at something like that. That's lost.
It's lost because you can do so much in post. I mean, the big difference, and this is a wild generalization that I don't think is, I think you can poke a million holes in this, but to me, it's like if you had to distill it down to one big change, it's where you do the work. And it used to be that, like, you did a ton of work before you got into that studio. You wrote the arrangement, you assembled your orchestra, your musicians, you had your engineer, you had your vocalist, and it's like when you got into that recording studio, there was so much that was that you had done to even get to that point, that what you were releasing to the public was, in many cases, I mean, you did a little mix afterwards, but in many cases, that was what was released, what was recorded in the studio. And now it's easier because so much of it is done after the fact. You get into the studio and you lay down what you need to lay down, and then you spend however many weeks or months in post, alone in the studio or with whoever you're collaborating with, just working it out. And it's, that there's that takes a lot of talent as well, but it's something has been lost as far as what gets done in that studio and how it reaches the public.
Sometimes a little too perfect. We lose the happy accidents, the things that made the moments iconic.
And the sense of what music has been for thousands of years.
And we'll be right back right after this.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Seth MacFarlane. So, as we're speaking about arrangements, fast forward through life, and you become friends with the Sinatra family, and then throughout this time, they you what is it? Like you become such good friends, they trust you, and they say, "Here, now you get to preserve all of these arrangements that Sinatra had and hadn't put out." How does that happen?
I mean, at the time when Frank Jr. was still alive, he was the steward of all of these charts. He was in charge of the handling and the curation of all of these, 1,200 boxes of charts that his father had left. And in many cases, he would do concerts and he would sing these charts. And when he passed away, that stewardship moved on to Tina Sinatra, his sister. And she was more, she's more of kind of like a ship's captain who's kind of overseeing it all. And so she wasn't out there singing, but she, had a maybe a more aggressive sense of what she wanted to do with this library that now had fallen under her care. And she called me and said, "Hey, would you like to acquire these things? I'd rather they not sit in a warehouse somewhere. I'd rather they be sung." And because there are 1,200 boxes. And I said, "Absolutely, I'd love to." And so when we got a hold of when we got a hold of this archive, I got together with my composer Joel McNeely and then Charlie Pignon, who is from Sinatra Enterprises, and we went through these boxes, hired an orchestra, and went over to the Fox lot and just played as many of them as we could to see what was in there, because oftentimes that's the only way to know what you have. You can look at the paper, but until you hear it, you just don't know. And what we found was there were a good 100 charts or so in there that Frank had never recorded that were out of those 1,200 boxes, you know, like 100 charts that were like peak Sinatra. You know, there was the song that was cut from the Come Fly With Me album. There was a Nelson Riddle recording of Shadow of Your Smile. There was a Nelson Riddle arrangement of How Did She Look, which I think is probably the best song on our record. And, you know, and of course there was Lush Life, which is the infamous recording session from 1958, where Sinatra recorded half the song and then bailed and said, let's pick it up again in about a year, and then never did.
And that would have been, that's been released on the box set. Like, I know I'd heard part of that, yep. As you said. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So we finished that song and we did the other half of it. And now it's a whole recording for the first time.
You're co-writing with Frank Sinatra.
7 decades. In a couple cases, there was a little bit of that. There was a Don Costa, I think it was Don Costa, arrangement of Arrivederci Roma. And there's a translation to English of that song that actually, I don't know whether it was written in Italian or in English, but there are two versions. There's an Italian version and an English version. But the English version has a refrain that was translated decades ago by Sammy Kahn or one of the greats. But there was an intro, a verse, that was on the Sinatra version that was all in Italian, and there was no English translation for it. And I don't speak Italian, and I don't know that I would subject anyone to my attempt to sing in Italian. And I'd never actually heard Sinatra sing in Italian either. Dean Martin did it a number of times, sure. But I'd never heard Sinatra do it. And so I figured, all right, well, probably Sinatra would have sung an English version, but there's no English version. So we had the verse translated, and then I just had to construct a lyric based on the content of the translation. So there was a little bit of writing here and there. There were a couple of songs. I mean, Give Me the Simple Life and Hurry Home, which are two of the songs on the album, contained a line here and there that I looked at and thought to myself, I bet you this is why Frank didn't want to record this.
Oh, really?
Because there were a couple of lines that were so hilariously and absurdly quaint that they, you know, even in like 1910, you might not be able to get away with it. So I did like the barest minimum of rewriting only when I felt it was absolutely necessary and only when I felt that it was something that Frank would have done too.
Now, when you do that, especially on a project like this, I mean, do you do it as you would do it? Do you cosplay a little bit?
No, you look at it as like working with a celebrity who's writing a book, and you're kind of the writer whose responsibility it is to make this, you know, feel like an actual book. So that was kind of how I approached it. It's like most of these lyrics are written. It's my job to fix this thing that needs to be fixed, but be as invisible about it as I can.
Hearing them, because as you say, most of it was intact, and even on the quaint lyrics, and maybe you're right, maybe that's the reason. But when you hear this, like, it's not that they weren't good enough. Like these songs are great, you know, and that's also compliments entirely to you as well for bringing them to life. And what they sound like, these sound like they could have been the classics that we've been hearing all of this time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was just somebody's choice 7 decades ago that they're not. I mean, a song like Give Me the Simple Life could have been a classic Sinatra recording that we all know. And for whatever reason, he didn't record it. Flying Down to Rio, which was the song that was cut from Come Fly With Me, is a song that could have been something that we all are very familiar with. But for whatever reason, that choice was made to cut it. And it's fun. It's, again, it's like finding, like, you know, the last M&M at the bottom of the bag. And it's like there was one more in there.
One more. Well, and we haven't even, like, Who's in Your Arms Tonight? The way the lady's vocals play around the ears. Like, that one specifically to me, that's almost like 1950s Disney-esque. Like,
very
I
much,
love
yeah.
What's going on there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Disney and certainly MGM and all those, I mean, they had some great vocal ensembles back then that were just people that, you know, 25 people who had worked so closely together that it sounded like you were listening to a barbershop quartet as far as how tight they were. And yeah, that's a song that the singers did a unbelievable job recapturing that in that they really took that challenge for what it was and met it, because yeah, it had to sound like a certain era where, you know, it was a very selfless era of singing, because every vocalist had to sound like they were just a piece of the a piece of the ensemble. It couldn't be too, you know, obvious, couldn't be too soulful, it couldn't be too there was no room for, you know, showboating. There wasn't, it just had to be like a single unit. And that's what kind of defines a lot of those choruses back then, is there's just so many singers, but they just blend together like one organism because they all do it every day. These were contract singers. And it's the same thing with the orchestras. The orchestras back then sound really, really special because you had, you know, 90 or 100, however many it was, players in the MGM studio orchestra. And you weren't just assembling those people every day. Those are the same people. You sat next to the same person every day for years. And so you developed this sound that was had the tightness of a small jazz ensemble, but there were 80 players.
And especially with those vocals, though. I mean, I love the way you put that, because, and Frank himself, I mean, there was so much melody in what he did. And I'm not a guy who's like, you know, music these days isn't good. I still love new music and everything. I, you know, run a radio station. I need to love new music anyway. But
yeah, yeah.
But there is that obvious difference, and each era has that. But, you know, as you were talking about, like when you first heard it and it's just so different than everything else that was being shoveled at you, like when you hear this, and you hear all of that melody that is a part of those arrangements, whereas now you put the vocal on top and a lot of time it's a little bit, you know, monotone maybe or whatever, but it's so noticeable.
They did things with vocal groups that just seem superhuman now. Like, for all how, you know, anytime we get cocky nowadays about what we're doing in the music industry, it's like I kind of like look at the Hi-Lows. There was a group called the Hi-Lows. This is a four-man group I'm sure you've heard of. You listen to any recording by the Hi-Lows, it's like, it just makes, for me at least, it just makes me want to never record anything again because I'm terrible. this is a four-man group that was doing such amazing things with harmony, and it's fun, and you listen to it and you're like, oh, it's easy to write it off, you know, as kitschy or light because it's so much fun. But when you really break it down, it's like, I defy anyone to do that nowadays. Like, it's astonishing. And they were doing this every day. And you hear it in this chorus with For Who's in Your Arms Tonight. What they're doing, even under the vocal, is just really sophisticated. And you know, you can really feel the composer's hand in a good way.
Did you have any challenges yourself on any of the vocal lines?
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone who's ever sung Lush Life, the song, you know, with the possible exception of Nat King Cole, who right. always sounds like he was just walked into the studio and did it and left, because he was just a genius above all. But yeah, that was a song. That was one that was a real challenge that took some work. It's notoriously one of the toughest vocals ever written, and it lives up to its name.
You did it. Survived, even.
That's, survived. I survived. Yeah, I was hell-bent not to let that one get me.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Seth MacFarlane. I'm looking at the track list around here, too. Like, oh, man, when Joanna loved me, I'm really drawn to those melancholic moments. A song like that. I don't know that song. Like, I know nothing about that. Was a brand new to me, that one.
Yeah, the only version I had, I guess, Tony Bennett might have. I don't know a lot of Tony Bennett, so I missed that one. But there was a Matt Monro recording of that song that I knew that was more of like kind of a 60s style slow swing. But this was, you know, this. I mean, any ballad by Nelson Riddle is just a gem. I mean, it's so classical in tone. It's you know, his use of the orchestra is so inventive, and that's all over this chart as well. But yeah, this not a super well known song.
I was noticing, and maybe this is complete coincidence, although I'd love it if it wasn't, but the arrangement of the songs, the track list, like, our narrator really doesn't end up in the best spot if you look at it from Arrivederci Rome to Hurry Home, Ain't You Ever Coming Back into Shadows. I mean, that really does play as a story.
Yeah, yeah, that is Joel McNeely, who is my composer arranger, who, since we've been doing these albums, the order of the songs always falls to him because he has a really unique talent for exactly that. And there was one more song actually that was we recorded and didn't include on the album. I can't. It was a Gordon Jenkins arrangement. It was the only Gordon Jenkins arrangement on the album. And it was called "That's All There Is," I think. And I mean, it's beautiful. It's unbelievably depressing. And we thought, well, maybe next time we'll end with something this down. But yes, there's a little bit of an arc.
So you've done the thing, you've doubled down on it. Frank doesn't release them, you record it and then don't release it on top of that.
Yes,
That's
exactly.
gutsy. No, well, like
Very meta.
what else is in this archive? And I'm sure you don't want to give too much away, but is there still enough that you do want to get to and record and release? Is it good enough?
Yeah, there are probably two albums worth, in these 1,200 boxes, there are probably two albums worth of additional songs that we haven't touched, that we know of. But there's a lot to go through. And again, an orchestra's expensive, so you go into the studio, you can't play 1,200 boxes worth of charts to know what you have. It's a slow process. And a lot of what we found were fragments of recordings that were familiar songs that have been rearranged for mostly television appearances. So there'd be a recording of something like Nature Boy, that was arranged for, or an arrangement rather, not a recording, an arrangement of Nature Boy that was designed to be recorded for a television series, and the thing is like cut down to 30 seconds or something like that. So there's a lot of those kinds of charts in the archives that are clearly from television appearances that did or didn't happen. And that would probably be, if we recorded those, that would probably be its own record, because it's not quite as listenable. It's more of a study in history. So when you're talking about actual songs like what we have here that have a beginning, middle, and end and feel substantial and feel finished and album ready, I would say they're probably two albums more.
I mean, just to bring up Nature Boy, I mean, another one of those, like, talk about competition, again, with Nat, with Bowie. I mean, the icons that have really nailed that song to be one of the
Yeah.
greatest of all time, that's.
Yeah, and a song that's like, find me somebody today who can write that song.
The story behind the guy who wrote that song is its own movie, by the way. That's,
Oh, is that right?
yeah, do you know anything of it? Like,
I don't actually
I
know.
can't, like, I've tried to fact check this and it's out there enough where it sounds like this is the fact, but I've been like, it's one of those stories where even if you told me it's true, it's hard to believe this is true because it was sort of a, what would, sort of a wild man of that era, bit of a nomad, I wouldn't say houseless, homeless, but sort of that's, and it, it just arrives and brings this song in. And that's, I'm sure, the romantic part of the story right there. But, and that gets a hold of it and then can't find the guy forever.
Oh, wow.
One of those things. And,
That's interesting.
it is. It's a song gifted down from the heavens or whatever,
Yeah,
something
yeah.
so different
Yeah,
than anything
I mean,
else.
that's whether you're religious or not, that's kind of what it is. I mean, there's just something that's what Irving Berlin was. He was a guy who was just he just had it in him. He just had these melodies, these tunes in him, and no one knew where the hell they came from. He didn't even know where they came from. In many ways, John Williams is the same way for our era. I'm sure if you asked him, he's, I mean, his, he, well, I have asked him. His answer is just that I just work really hard, which, of course, we know that's a fraction of it, but it's the rest of it. Well, a lot of people work hard, and 99.9999% of them are not, giving us Star Wars, E.T., Raiders of the Lost Ark, Jaws, Jurassic Park, Harry Potter. It's just the list just goes on and on. There's something that you were gifted with that is
The
nothing to
rest
do
of
with
us don't
hard
have
work.
that. Yeah. I recently was talking with Ben Folds. Of course, Ben spends a lot of his time in the classical realm. And he's saying the same thing. It's like Ben Folds, who is one of those people who can you can throw a word to him and he can literally write a song in 10 minutes, front to back, even with an orchestra. And that's amazing talent, but it somehow still is not exactly like John Williams. That's.
Yeah, there's that's I mean that's depending on how if it's a great song, sure. It sounds like maybe more of a party trick,
Well, it
but
is a bit of a party trick, but
if it's a great song, then great. But yeah, no, it's when you look at these people who have these repertoires that are just conspicuously long, and Irving Berlin, I think for many people, tops that list. you know, Richard Rodgers certainly is up there. Just one right after another. I mean, it's, you know, oh, The Sound of Music, Edelweiss, You'll Never Walk Alone, Climb Every Mountain, blah, blah, blah. It just goes on and on and on. Okay, something was going on with the way this guy's brain is wired that is special.
And for those songs to just always connect.
And it's strange. It's like, you know, I've hunted far and wide for, look, there's tons of great composers. There are tons of great arrangers. There's tons of great singers. And so, you know, there are a lot of great musicians out there right now, but I have hunted far and wide to find someone who can do what Irving Berlin did, what Richard Rodgers did. Doesn't exist that I have found. I've found arrangers who can arrange with the same kind of thought process that Nelson Riddle or Billy May did, but you, and I don't know what it is that was in the water back then, where somebody like Richard Rodgers or, you know, Cole Porter could do this one song after another, and it just vanished.
And that doesn't. No, I agree. 100% doesn't exist.
And I can only imagine this because they were all kind of surrounding each other, and they're all kind of trying to one up each other.
But even like the ones that's like barely lesser than that, like Cy Coleman, you know, mm-hmm. or something like that. Like, Why Try to Change Me Now? One of the greatest songs of all time, too. You know, yeah. He might not have been hitting at that level with every single song, but like every third song would be that, you know.
Yeah, which is, I mean, again, try and find one. It's, you know, how do you write that? That's the thing. Like, how do you, the song, The Sound of Music, how do you write that song in 2025? How do you start? And does it need to be attached to a piece of IP of significance so that people hear it and it means something to them? There's so many questions I have.
Well, so on the more playful side of all this, you know, bringing it back around to Sinatra, and it's really funny, by the way, watching maybe in a Severance type of way sometimes, like you put on the suit, you become this. You put on the t-shirt, you become Ted. You know, it's like when you put on the suit and you're embodying this type of sound that you do so well, again, we're talking 9 albums of this level. Like there's no Frank biopic yet. Could you do that?
A Sinatra biopic?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I'd be flattered to be asked, but I don't know. That's a whole other skill set.
And that's what I'm saying, because you know it so intimately, and that's what I'm getting at. You know, it's not an impression. You're not doing an impression. You know,
I do it because I love. And I, look, this is something that in the more I read about Sinatra and certainly about Nat King Cole, I share the love for the orchestras, and I know both of those performers loved the orchestras, and you could hear it in their, more than any other two vocalists at the time, you could hear it in their songs, the time that they would give to the band. There's a recording of Laura, the song Laura, the Johnny Mercer and David Raxon song, in which there's a 1 minute long intro where it's just the orchestra before Sinatra even sings. And that only comes from a singer who just loves the ensemble. Like, and he was, Sinatra had an enormous classical music collection. He was a big fan of orchestras himself. And so that's kind of why I do it. When I go and I perform with, you know, the San Francisco Symphony or the Boston Pops or the Houston Symphony or you know, Chicago or Philadelphia or wherever, half the reason I do it is I love to sit there and listen to that ensemble. And in many cases it's, you know, 80 players and there's just nothing like it. And so that's something that's kind of what motivates me to do all this. I love the singing and I was trained as a singer by some great people, but I love hearing the orchestra and that's kind of what drives me.
It's a nice pure reason for that, honestly. That's,
I mean, it's if you don't really appreciate it until you've sat in that room and you go, oh, okay, this is like crack.
And you've had some good rooms too. I mean, and you're gonna have some. I saw next year you're doing the Disney Hall, but you've got it's sort of a residency, right? Or at least 3 dates in Vegas coming up in July.
Yeah, is that 3 dates a residency or is that
it's a run? It's a 3-date residency.
It's a stint.
So what are you doing? I mean, are you concentrating on this? Is that what we're going to be hearing for those shows?
Yeah, well, I mean, part of what was asked of me for that show was to really focus it on, if not necessarily the album, using the album as a springboard to focus the show on the music of Sinatra. So I like to mix it up. There are a lot of charts from a lot of different sources from that era that I like to dig around in and perform. And so it probably won't be solely Sinatra, but there'll certainly be a lot of that.
You're still doing Sinatra in Vegas, and that's
yes, that we're doing.
There's a little bit of weight to that, like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I did it once before at the Wynn. We did a few nights. I think this was like 2014 or something, about maybe 9 years ago, and that was a thrill. You know, that was you're in Vegas, you have an orchestra, it's a great theater, and you know, this will be not the first time I've done it, but the first time I've done it in a while.
Yeah.
Actually, that's not true. Liz Gillies and I did Vegas. That was more of a concert hall. The Smith Center is more of a concert hall. But this will be more of a kind of true nightclub proper.
Beautiful. Hope you catch one of those. That sounds fun. On the other side of your career too, like this ain't the only thing you got going on. It never is. You're producing the Naked Gun movie. And again, talk about, you know, filling some big shoes. I've only seen the trailer, but that looks to capture the mood. We're again talking about the same thing here. To be able to capture the mood of something like that, that couldn't have been an easy feat.
It wasn't. And thank God I'm not the one who had to do it. It was. yeah, I mean, my contribution to this was the idea however many years ago that, you know, Liam Neeson. And I think it was after we had him on TED 2, and he was so funny and was so disciplined when it came to not playing the comedy and just letting the comedy be on the page. I had this thought that, like, God, Liam Neeson's probably the only actor alive who could play Frank Drebin in a remake of The Naked Gun, because those kinds of actors are kind of, they don't really exist anymore. The Robert Mitchum, Gregory Peck, you know, Peter Graves, actor, Robert Stack, you know, these guys who were just so much gravitas, but it was truthful. There was so much gravitas and so much weight to their performances, but it was honest. It wasn't a parody. It wasn't, they could get away with it. And that's what Liam does. Liam, he's kind of the one of the last of a breed of a certain kind of actor that is truly great, but has, you know, this voice that's so imitatable for a lot of people. and so I took a stab at it with a handful of my writers and, you know, one from the Orville and a few from Family Guy. And we kind of kept feeling like what we were making was a cover band version of The Naked Gun. And it was the same reason that I kind of abandoned the Flintstones many years ago when I was doing that pilot for Warner Brothers. I just kind of feel like there's nothing I'm bringing to this that needs me.
Which is great that you can actually realize that and not just see it through like a lot of people would have.
Yeah, you're getting handed the keys to a car that has a lot of great miles on it, and you don't want to be the one to crash it. So I stepped away from that, and Erica Huggins, who runs Fuzzy Door, runs my company, linked up with Akiva Schaffer. And he and his writers took a stab at it and had a very different result. And sometimes it's just the right person coming in fresh. And they wrote a really funny script. And so we said, let's make it. And he directed it. The screenings up till now have been really gratifying. People are loving it. A lot of laughs. And you know, we'll see. I mean, it's a big swing, but he's done a hell of a job. It's in the right hands.
Yeah. Well, like I said, if it's anything like that trailer, I mean, chef's kiss on that. And then The Burbs, I also want to bring up really quickly too, because as we're talking about taking, you know, these older stories and bringing them in, is that sort of a similar kind of situation?
In some ways, yeah. Yeah. It's The Burbs is more of, I think, more of a departure from the original. And it fits much more with today's landscape. It's so funny. That movie, I remember that movie. I had a laser disc of that movie in college.
I have the laser disc of that movie.
Yeah. And it was like, and I remember exactly, because you had to like flip over the laser discs. I remember exactly where it ends and that weird fade out comes where you gotta flip over the disc and they have to cut the movie in three pieces. And God, I watched that movie on repeat throughout so much of the 90s. I loved that movie. I still, try to say, if anyone will go along with me, that that might be Tom Hanks's finest performance. There is so much brilliance in his
There's that
performance.
that's you know what you do have the argument there. I mean, I agree with you, but you have the argument.
It's like, yes, he's fantastic in Castaway. Like, Philadelphia is wonderful. There's many great actors, I think, who could have really done Philadelphia as great as Tom Hanks was. There's nobody but Tom Hanks who could have done The Money Pit or The Burbs. Impossible. They're just two of the most brilliant comedic performances ever. And so yeah, I think again, The Burbs luckily is not it's not quite as hallowed a ground as The Naked Gun is, but it has its cult fan base, and hopefully they'll be happy with it.
And it hadn't even occurred to me like that there was so much story you could get out of that. But once I started hearing about that, I was like, oh yeah, that's kind of right for that. That's
Yeah. No, yeah, they've figured out a way to kind of give it a little bit more. I mean, it's a different genre. It's more of like a mystery. And so they figured out a way to give it a little bit more, give the story a little bit more backbone in this version. I mean, the original, it's the ending is so absurd. The fact that he's got the trunk full of skeletons in his car, it's like, oh, well, isn't that lucky for Tom Hanks and Rick Dukeman and Bruce Dern that this was so convenient. There, it turns out they're right. And it reeks a little bit of a test screening where there was an ending like Little Shop of Horrors where the plant eats everybody and the audience goes, oh, we don't like that. And then so they have to rewrite it and reshoot a happier ending. The Burbs, I have nothing to base that on other than my gut. The Burbs reeks of that kind of a scenario where maybe that might have happened.
Yeah, right. And quickly, it's like Ted, you got more Ted. You're still like you finding new ways to get stories out of Ted.
Oh God, milking that cash cow for all it's worth. Yeah, no, Ted, the first season of Ted on Peacock did shockingly, amazingly well. And I say that because it had been a while since we did the second movie and I had no idea how it was going to be received.
Because people love that character. It's true.
Yeah, I mean, it was the biggest hit, I say this with a straight face, the biggest hit Peacock has ever had.
Congratulations.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a trepidation when you go into something like that when it's been a while. And people loved it. People were like all over it. And it stayed at number one for about 2 months straight, I think, as far as comedies. It was the most watched comedy across all platforms for like 2 months straight, kind of quietly, actually. There wasn't, I mean, it got a lot of buzz initially, but it kind of held for a much longer time than I think people realize. And so we did a season two, and I think it's funnier than the first one. I think we got back in our groove quickly enough in the first season, and I think the second season is going to be a step up further still. There's some really fun episodes.
Riding that wave. Yeah, I mean, there's still great comedy out here, but we're in such an era where, and that happens, 80s comedy was very much of its time, but we're in this era where this, even as we're talking about things like The Naked Gun, that's not the type of comedy that you usually get. And so for me at least, I say speaking, like Ted was something that I needed. I needed to
Yeah.
have that type of comedy because I'm not getting that type of comedy anymore, and I wonder if that's what tapped into a lot of people. Not to discredit, you've got top-notch writing on there and top-notch acting and
No,
everything
but I think you're
else.
right. I think it's exactly what you're saying. I mean, it's yeah, no, at the same time, yeah, it's a great writing staff and it's a great cast and it scratched an itch that certainly at the time, and I guess even now, needs to be scratched. Like there isn't a lot of comedy out there, and there certainly isn't a lot of that type of comedy. There's a lot of comedy that's really trying to fucking win awards. There's a lot
Comedy
of
that you
comedy
don't
that,
laugh out loud at.
right. You're not laughing, but you should be laughing and you're going, interesting. And it's I think that that's something that's that is you sort of hit the nail on the head that like we're this these in, at times very sort of obvious grabs for Emmys when really what your audience just wants to do is laugh their asses off. And Ted certainly makes no attempt to do the former. Although, I mean, come on, our visual effects team just, there's just nobody better out there right now. Our cast is fantastic. Listen, they all deserve Emmys if you ask me, but that's not why we do it. It's really designed to just get the biggest laughs we can. And yeah, there's less and less of that now. There seems to be a sense that you have to somehow do something that's going to win you a Pulitzer Prize or win you a Golden Globe. And I think Pulitzer Prize is for journalism, so that wouldn't work.
Put it on paper, then you've got journalism.
Put it on paper, yeah. But it's, you know, we do, and look, that has its place. That's your thing, great. But Ted really is about, as is The Naked Gun, really is just about making as many people laugh as we can, as often as we can.
Well, mission accomplished. I saw, I will admit, I didn't read the article. I'm doing one of those where I only read the headline, which is dangerous. But it was a headline
that's all
was why adult animation might be saving TV. And I feel like that kind of plays into it. I mean, I think there's a lot of other stuff that goes in on that as well. But what, you know, what King of the Hill is coming back, of course, that's, you know, the big news on that one. You know, welcome that back into the animation block. But I think there's a lot of truth in that as well. You know, what we're actually tuning in for, you know, of course, what we used to call appointment viewing, you know, has changed so much. But it feels like that's the stuff that still people are still talking about.
Yeah, I mean, adult animation always seems to hang in there when other genres come and go. I mean, it helps that the characters don't age, that, like, you know, Peter's perpetually 42 years old, Stewie's perpetually one.
Although and King so of the Hill, they did age him, which I thought
they
was
did. That's right, they did.
Yeah.
They did a little bit of that.
That's a rarity, though. That's a rarity. Yeah.
Yeah, and they were talking about that, I think, a long time ago. I remember when we first started Family Guy, King of the Hill was talking about aging their characters season by season. I don't know if they ended up, I don't think they ended up doing that in the original, but maybe they're doing it now with the reboot. But yeah, it's, you know, for now, I mean, I think that there will come a time when The Simpsons and Family Guy are no longer as welcome as they are now, but they've held out a lot longer than I ever thought they would.
It's more surprising if, especially an animated series, it used to be that Family Guy, of course, you know, they take it away and it comes back and we've heard that story. It's almost more surprising now if it doesn't stick around, I think, you know, for whatever reason that is.
I mean, yeah, I think to some degree there's a lot more that can go wrong with an animated series than can go wrong with a live action series. I think there are a lot more successful live action series. And look, in my experience, the talent pool for live action is, I'm look like having done both, directing a movie as a live action director is not easy, but it's a hell of a lot easier than directing an animated
really?
Film or an animated TV show. Yeah, because there's so much more that can go wrong, and there's so much more that I think people don't really realize goes into this. I mean, things like exposure sheets, which I'm sure most people don't know what the hell that is. You can't. That can make or break an animated series. And they look like pieces of graph paper with like scribblings and numbers. And what that tells you is, you know, when Peter Griffin falls through a table, is he falling like this and he's bouncing like Bugs Bunny? Or is he falling like this and it's a hard hit like The Simpsons perfected? And even something like that can make or break the tone of an animated show. And that's just like one tiny piece. It's you have to storyboard something as if it's your final cut, and you have to make all these guesses that normally in live action you can mess around with in editing, and you can say, well, either there's this version and there's this version, this works.
I see. Yeah.
With animation, you have to know exactly what it's going to look like cut for cut from day one, and there's a lot of guesswork involved and a lot that can go wrong along the way. So it is, I mean, it's surprising that any animated show ever gets done, but there are a lot of great ones. I mean, and there are more, I think, now than there have been at any point in time that I can remember. I mean, Bob's Burgers is fantastic. I mean, Lauren Bouchard is such a talented guy, and that was a show. I not to pat myself on the back. I do remember when Bob's Burgers premiered, thinking, okay, these guys get it. Because there was a whole slew of shows that kind of came and went for a while up to that point, and then here comes Bob's Burgers, and you kind of saw from the pilot, yeah, this is they knew what mistakes not to make before they got to this point. But there's a lot of them, you know. I mean, there's South Park is still around, Family Guy's still around, American Dad's still around, The Simpsons is still around, obviously, the granddaddy of them all, and
forever and ever.
Yeah, and they just kind of keep coming. So maybe people are getting better at it.
That's the question. If The Simpsons one day, whenever that is, that they say, "All right, we're going to end it." Maybe it's decades from now. Do you keep going, or do you bow out before? If you get the choice, do you go after the crown, or do you like, nah?
Well, I don't. It's not like, you know, Hitler and Eva Braun, where it's like we're both in the bunker and you off yourself, and so I'll off myself. I don't think that's what's going to happen.
That's not it.
You know, it's like it's. I think it's. No, I think we'll go as long or as short as is desired by our audience. We'll stay as long as we're welcome, and hopefully not any longer. So if people still want more Family Guy, then we'll keep delivering it.
Y'all do a hell of a job, and I mean it. And especially considering what you were just saying about the tightrope you have to walk. I mean, it is sort of mind-blowing when you put it in that scope to be that consistent for as long as everybody has. That's not nothing right there. So congrats on all of that and all of your other projects and the movies coming up, but especially with this record. Again, Lush Life, the Lost Sinatra arrangements, and you're going to be playing the... where is it? The Voltaire? Is that right?
Voltaire, yeah.
Voltaire in Vegas, July 3rd, 4th, and 5th. And Seth, man, this has been such a fun conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time.
All right. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
My thanks to Seth. Lush Life, the Lost Sinatra Arrangements is out now. Thanks to you for checking out the episode. I do hope you hit that subscribe button if you're not already. Before you get out of here, you'll get new interviews just like this one every single week. Multiple interviews every single week. Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, anywhere you get your podcast from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With, and please do give the series a rating and leave a review while you're at it. After that, you can head over to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show, Monday through Friday, starting 6 p.m. Eastern. You'll get 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s. You get the best in new music, bonus interviews, lots of music news as well. In fact, one of my recent shows featured some classics and favorites from Simon & Garfunkel, Bob Dylan, Valerie June, Tori Amos, Leonard Cohen, Everything But the Girl, Thompson Twins, Pixies, Pumpkins, Wet Leg, PJ Harvey, Amy Winehouse, and my interview with Tom Jones. That's what you get when you tune in weeknights, 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. The address is always the same. It's at Kyle Meredith. I do hope you like and follow. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time. Consequence Podcast Network.
All right, cool, man.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.